For today's A to Z podcast, we will be discussing the intersections between Islamic law, international humanitarian law, and human rights law. Alka and I thought that this was an important topic to tackle for several reasons. First, for our own edification. Islam is the second largest religion in the world. It's the official religion in 26 countries, and Muslims are the majority in 49 countries. So if we're talking solutions to the prevention and prohibition of torture, it's clear that Islamic law will be a key part of any such solution. The second aspect is that we both represent Muslim clients. Their faith is an integral aspect of their daily life. As lawyers, I believe we have a duty to understand this so we can advocate for their right to freely practice their religious beliefs. And in one of our previous episodes, we were very privileged to have Muhammadu Salahi speak to us. And I referred to the fact that in the Guantanamo diary, he described the many experiences and exposures that he had to psychological torture at Guantanamo. And this included the fact that he was forbidden from practicing any Islamic ritual. And he described how this denial of the ability to practice his faith fed into the continuous forms of psychological torture to which he was exposed, and the extent to which it fed into the war against religion that's been practiced since the Twin Towers fell. And this ties into this larger question of Islamophobia, the extent to which Islam is misunderstood and demonized, such that many Muslims are profiled and targeted simply because of their faith. So what we are aiming to do today is to strip away these preconceptions and to learn about the many ways in which Islam and Islamic law can play a positive role in ensuring effective protection during armed conflict and the extent to which it can synergize with effective human rights implementation. And to do this, we have Professor Ahmed Al-Dawoodi and Dr. Julie Fraser with us today. And I'll hand over to my brilliant colleague Alka Pradhan to introduce them.
Dr. Ahmed Al-Dawoodi is the legal advisor for Islamic law and jurisprudence at the International Committee for the Red Cross, and also a visiting professor at the Geneva Academy of International Humanitarian Law and Human Rights in Geneva, Switzerland. He has published extensively, I think more than several dozen articles and book chapters on Islamic law. And he's the author of a book called The Islamic Law of War, Justifications and Regulations. And Dr. Julie Fraser is assistant professor of law based at the Netherlands Institute of Human Rights at Utrecht University. She has also written extensively. She has worked with the UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women in Geneva in 2016. She's undertaken field research in Indonesia. And her research has focused on the role of cultural norms and actors as effective agents in the domestic implementation of international law. Interesting in particular to me, and I'm sure to Melinda, is the book project that she's currently working on, looking at the intersections of law and culture in the International Criminal Court, and in particular, at the potential use of Islamic law, the potential role for Islamic law in the cases before the International Criminal Court. So we are thrilled to have them both with us today to teach us a little bit more about how Islamic law is complementary to international law and why perhaps we should be paying more attention to it. And once again, as I do periodically on this podcast and everywhere I speak, I want to emphasize that I speak only for myself, not for the Department of Defense, certainly not for the Department of Defense, and not for any of the other guests on our show. They all speak very, very well for themselves. Well, thank you again for joining us. And I'll jump right in with a question for Ahmed, if you don't mind. I was wondering if we could open by having you explain to us the concept of Islamic law and the differences, if any, right, for those listening who are not familiar, between Islamic law and Sharia.
Islamic law is the bedrock of the Islamic civilization. And it is one of the unifying elements of the different cultures of Islamic civilization throughout history, but also and of the Muslim world at present, including Muslim minorities in non-Muslim majority countries. And it is a core component of identity, heritage, but I can also add also the future of some Muslim majority states. And it is one of the three major legal systems in the world today, both in terms of the application in the national legislations, but also when it comes to the choice of the practicing Muslim individuals to implement certain areas of Islamic rules upon themselves. And also when it comes to international treaties, as we all know, many Muslim majority states ratify treaties with the caveat that any obligations must not be incompatible with Islamic law. And at the moment, we have three states who apply solely Islamic law, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, and the islands of the Maldives. And most of the rest of the Muslim majority countries apply amalgamation of mostly civil law and Islamic law, and to a much lesser extent, Islamic law and common law. And in the constitutions of a number of Muslim majority states, there is an article that states that Islamic law is a source of legislation, or for other countries, the source of legislation. And in addition to this, we have four countries that have in their names the word Islamic, like the Islamic, like Afghanistan, Iran, Mauritania, and Pakistan. So this is just to say that it is Islamic law is, I think, the most effective legal framework for regulating human behavior in many issues, from what people eat, wear, marry, divorce, make war or peace, or do business, etc. And this is mainly because it has what I call a built-in compliance mechanism, or what is described by some as self-imposed legal system in some of its areas. So it has an impact on the daily lives of billions, not only in Muslim majority contexts, but also in non-Muslim societies as well. And the amount of human suffering or alleviation of human suffering or respect for human rights, Islamic law is part of, has not been taken seriously enough yet. So this is, I want to start by thanking you all for organizing this this podcast. So still, what is Islamic law? It is a legal system that goes back to the early years of the emergence of the religion of Islam. And it is based on specific sources and certain methods for the lawmaking process. And this set of sources and methods used by the jurists to derive these rules of law is the subject of the academic discipline known as usul al-fiqh, or legal theory or methodology. And Islamic law is, it is important to keep this in mind, Islamic law is comprised of two legal genres. What we usually hear as Sharia, and we can speak about it a bit more detail later, which literally means path or way, and fiqh, which literally means, it is very significant to the Arabic use of this word, because it literally means understanding, and usually translated as jurisprudence, which is defined by the jurist as the practical rules derived or developed by the jurists from specific sources or proofs. And if we look at the Sharia, it is only a tiny part of Islamic law, while the greatest majority of what falls under Islamic law actually is included in this body that's known as fiqh or jurisprudence. And what does Islamic law govern? Islamic law includes actually both secular and religious dimensions. In general, the areas regulated by Islamic law includes acts of worship, family law, commercial law, international law, constitutional law, and criminal law, among other areas. And Islamic law consists largely of what we can say four main categories: legal rulings, legal maxims and fatwas, I mean, translated as non-binding legal opinions developed by the jurist, and finally, court judgments. So this is in brief what is Islamic law.
I've learned so much more in this last 10 minutes than I have over my entire life. And Julie, you've also written a lot on Islamic law, and in particular, you've written on why it's important for international courts and tribunals to give more reference to Islamic law. I think one of your recent articles is titled A Seat at the Table, Islamic Law's Neglected Potential in Universalizing International Humanitarian Law. So, Julie, why do you believe this topic is so important?
Thanks very much, Melinda, for the question. And I echo Ahmed in saying thank you for the invitation to be here and to discuss these topics with you. And I also would like to say at the outset that I learned a lot from what Ahmed just said. I myself am not an Islamic lawyer. I am an international lawyer. So that's the perspective at which I come at this discussion, looking at what role Islamic law could or should play in relation to how international law is understood, interpreted, and applied. And as you said, Melinda, my argument is that it is important to look at this topic, which Ahmed himself just said has really been sort of neglected or not taken seriously enough yet in international law. And I pretty much have two reasons for why I think we need to spend more time and attention looking at Islamic law. And that's principle and pragmatism. The first one being principle. I think that international law is not international enough in the sense that it is very dominated by Western states, Western actors, and by European legal systems. This results, of course, from the history of empire and colonialism. And there have been many different studies that have been done that show this dominance of Western states, both sort of before the creation of the UN in 1945, as well as afterwards. And a lot of this work has been done by Twail scholars, and I'm going to give a shout out here to Anthony Angi and a lot of the work he's done in this field, but also other scholars like Anthea Roberts, who published a study of the International Court of Justice in 2017. And she really asked the question, how international is international law, and found it coming up short. And so while organizations like the ICJ and the ICC are supposed to be sui generis international institutions, I've really yet to see them draw from Islamic law in the same way that they do common and civil law traditions. And as Ahmed just said, Islamic law is one of the three major legal systems of the world. So I look at this and say, oh, why are we really focusing on these two and excluding this one system that, as Ahmed says, has such a huge impact around the world, both at the state level and the individual level? So I say that the dominance of these Western legal systems, and at the same time, the marginalization of Islamic law, but other non-Western legal systems, harms the legitimacy of international law and its institutions. So that's sort of the first reason there about principle. And the other point that I have about why it's important to look at this topic is pragmatism. I myself came from practice, so I'm always very interested in what happens on the ground and in practice. And I think that it's important to also pay attention to Islamic law because it can be a way to bridge the gap between international law, sort of, you know, at the sort of theoretical level, and what's happening on the ground in practice and the realization of those international law norms. There's a big gap between implementation of international law and what happens in the daily life of people. And this is really important because much of international law benefits individuals and communities around the world through things like the human rights norms, but also environmental law, the laws of war and things like this. So if we're not seeing those laws implemented, we're having real harm experienced by real people. And I think that the use of something like Islamic law, which is widely respected around the world, widely used, can actually help the implementation of these international norms at the local level.
Thank you so much. I think it's, you know, it's really interesting what you say about international law not fully addressing, you know, Islamic law in the perhaps the ways that it should, because, you know, Ahmed, I'm familiar with your publication, IHL in Islam, an overview, and it's a little bit different, you know, with regards to the ICRC. I mean, the ICRC, of course, deals with issues concerning humanitarian law and the laws of war. And you write about a little bit of the points of correspondence and divergence. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, about how the ICRC engages with Islamic law, or how international humanitarian law as a whole engages with Islamic law.
Yes, the ICRC mission, as you all know, is to protect the lives and dignities of victims of armed conflict and other situations of violence, and to prevent the suffering by promoting and strengthening international humanitarian law. And this is in the statement of the mission of the ICRC, and universal humanitarian principles. And for almost three decades now, the ICRC has been involving or seeking to involve, among other cultures and norms and traditions, Islamic institutions and scholars to protect and assist victims of armed conflict in these countries. So it is of paramount importance for the ICRC and other similar organizations, but also its legal and operational expertise to engage with experts of various kinds in the Islamic world and draw on their knowledge in order to have what Julie just mentioned, common grounds to enhance the respect of IHL and alleviate the suffering of the victims of armed conflict in these contexts. So in engagement with communities affected by armed conflict, we need to engage with local sources that influence the behavior of arms carriers in order to universalize IHL and to find common principles that help in protecting and assisting victims of armed conflict. And ICRC has done this in different parts of the world. For example, in 1998, the ICRC delegation in Somalia published a study on the traditional Somali behavior in warfare. And also in 2009, the ICRC delegation in Canberra coordinated a study on the traditional warfare practices in the Pacific and highlighted also similarities with IHL. And from experience, we see that adopting an operationally focused, transversal and context-specific approach is essential in the effort to alleviate human suffering and address the humanitarian consequences of armed conflict. So I think that this is not a luxurious intellectual engagement. It is more of an imperative to save people's lives.
You know, when we talk about those points that you just mentioned, who do you think are the key parties who need to understand that, who need that education?
I think first of all, mainly those parties involved in armed conflict. And as we all know, the greatest majority of current armed conflicts now are non-international armed conflicts, which means that a party to the conflict at least is a non-state armed groups. And in most cases, in most of these armed conflicts, we have non-state armed groups who use Islamic law as their source of reference. So it is important to find common ground and to engage with them using their own source of reference in order to enhance compliance towards IHL. So I think that this is the main target. But also at the same time, it is essential also to engage with Islamic law experts, with also Islamic institutions, especially those who have expertise in Islamic law. And this is mainly to universalize IHL, because the degree of commonality between the two frameworks is huge, and this is much needed to universalize IHL and to alleviate the suffering of the victims of armed conflict. And this is badly needed, actually, not only when it comes to Islamic law, but also when it comes to IHL, because IHL, on one hand, is still not widely studied in many law schools in different parts of the world. This is one thing. The other thing, as Julie just mentioned, IHL is seen as actually a Western slash European product. In other words, it is alien to other cultures and traditions. And I think once other cultures and traditions see the commonality, it becomes globally honored framework, and this will help compliance. And we can speak about some of the issues that Islamic law addresses, if we have time.
Thanks very much, Ahmed, for those excellent points as to how a greater understanding of Islamic law can promote greater universalization of international humanitarian law and indeed compliance. And Julie, I think you've written on similar themes in the context of international criminal law. Earlier, you talked about Anthea Roberts' groundbreaking study on whether international law is truly international. And in the context of the ICJ, she found out it came out quite short. And I believe you've written on similar issues in the context of the International Criminal Court and the extent to which the ICC has or has not referenced Islamic law in key decisions. And I believe one example you've given in your writings is the Gaddafi case, where the court was required to determine whether Libya was willing and able to conduct domestic proceedings against both Saif Gaddafi and Abdullah Senussi. And that core question as concerns Saif Gaddafi had to look into the use of amnesties under domestic law. And you critiqued the failure, I believe, of the judges to consider this question by reference to Islamic law. Now, can you tell us more about this example and why Islamic law could and should have been relevant to the judges?
Yeah, thanks, Melinda. I think this is a good example, and it builds upon, as you mentioned, Anthea Roberts' work and her study of the International Court of Justice and its operation over many decades now. The ICC is obviously a much newer institution, but it follows in a lot of the same ways what we've seen to date from some of these other international bodies that deal with what international law broadly, but also international human rights law and now international criminal law. There have been some specific studies also done of the ICJ in terms of whether or to what extent it has looked at Islamic law. And like Robert's study, they also confirm that there are scant references to Islamic law in the judgments itself. Scholars like Lombardi and Powell have noted that the court rarely and sporadically refers to Islamic law in its judgments. And it's not just the judgments, but it's mainly in separate opinions, whether they're concurring or dissenting opinions, that we see greater reference to Islamic law. And if you look at those studies, it really comes down to the judges and the individual judges and their backgrounds. The very first reference to Islamic law came in the North Sea Continental Shelf case in 1969. And this was in a separate opinion by Judge Amun of Lebanon. Since then, there have been other references, but overall, these scholars have concluded that it really is without any sort of real methodology or thorough examination of international law. So there still tends to be this sort of ad hoc treatment of of Islamic law within the ICJ jurisprudence. And it's also sort of interesting to note here that it's not just the European judges or the Western judges that rely on European ways of knowing. Also, judges from Muslim majority states themselves often have this preference or predilection to referring to European legal norms and traditions. And I think this also just shows the dominance or the centricity of European ways of knowing in international law. So skipping forward then from the ICJ to the ICC, as I mentioned, you find sort of a similar outcome here where there has been very limited reference to Islamic law. In my study, I found that there has been no substantive engagement with Islamic law. Where there have been references to it, it's more in terms of background or contextual elements. For example, the case in relation to Mali of the recent violence in Timbuktu. There was a lot of discussion about Islamic law in the sense of the community there, which is majority Muslim, the shrines that were destroyed, the practices that people had, most of the victims were themselves found to be Muslims. But that didn't then get taken up by the judges also to look at the norms of Islamic law and how they related to the human rights violations that were alleged, as well as the IHL violations that were alleged and ultimately found. So I am hopeful that there is much more opportunity for the ICC to develop and really increase its engagement with Islamic law in a substantive fashion. And I'm really hoping that that is taken up by the court in its present case, also in relation to Mali, which is the Al-Hassan case, and also some of the Sudanese cases that are coming before the court now. Most recently is the Al-Rahman case. The example that you mentioned before about Gaddafi's reign in Libya, this case also came before the ICC. The situation was referred by the UN Security Council, which is also a point for debate, maybe for another podcast. But in this situation, the UN Security Council referred the matter to the International Criminal Court. And this was the conflict that came out of the Arab Spring, where we saw the fall of Muammar Gaddafi's reign after some four decades in power in Libya. And the OTP investigated and brought charges against several different individuals, including initially Muammar Gaddafi himself and also his son, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi. And partially because of the fact that Libya itself was not a state party to the Rome Statute, I think Libya sought to challenge the ICC's jurisdiction over these cases. And this came before the pretrial chamber in the sense of looking at the admissibility of the case and the ICC's complementarity regime. And this was where the court looked at amnesties under Libyan law to see whether or not that related to the charges against Saif al-Islam Gaddafi and whether or not he could be tried for the same charges by the International Criminal Court. And I thought this was an interesting example because in taking their decision, the ICC's pretrial chamber really spends time in their decision going through a range of different human rights bodies and judgments to look at how amnesties are treated in these different systems. So they look at how the African Commission of Human Rights has looked at the situation of amnesties, how the Inter-American Court of Human Rights has looked at amnesties across largely the Latin American continent, and also the European Court of Human Rights and how they've dealt with amnesties vis-a-vis human rights violations. But they then also go to the international level and they look at the UN Human Rights Committee. Then they swap over to look more closely at criminal law and they examine the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and then the specialized bodies in Sierra Leone and Cambodia. And having done this sort of big survey around the world, they conclude that amnesties and pardons for serious acts such as murder is incompatible with internationally recognized human rights. And I had to stop myself and think, well, this judgment relates to Libya, which is a majority Muslim state. Over 95% of the population there are Muslim. And Islamic law is also a source of law in Libya, which Ahmed mentioned in his previous answer. And I wondered then why the court didn't think to look at the Arab Charter on human rights or to look at a lot of the jurisprudence from Islamic law that relates specifically to amnesties and human rights. There's a huge body of Islamic law that relates to these topics that the court could have also sampled and referred to in their judgment. So here I really see this disconnect between the ICC seemingly trying to present its findings in a universal or international way, but then excluding Islamic law despite its salience in this present case.
Thanks very much, Julie. You provided us with a beautiful overview of how these cases, or this case in particular, came before the ICC and the issues that the court was grappling with, and yet its seeming failure to actually cite to the most important or the most relevant sources of law. Now, as you mentioned, the Gaddafi case concerned complementarity issues, and the current prosecutor, Karim Khan KC, has made a great deal about the importance of complementarity, that international courts should really be a point of last resort. So clearly the court will be grappling with this issue as to whether domestic trials should be preferred or should be the first port for crimes as opposed to the ICC in future situations. Now, Libya was obviously a post-conflict country that was attempting to implement transitional justice. Are you aware of other examples where Islamic law has been used as a form of traditional justice in a conflict or post-conflict setting?
So this is a great question, and it sort of goes back to what triggered my interest in Islamic law in relation to conflict resolution. And that was an article I read by Sharif Bassioni. And I've subsequently then read his book that looks at this issue of Sharia and Islamic criminal justice in time of war and peace. And Sharif Bassioni was, of course, you know, sort of one of the founders or architects of international criminal law and the Rome Statute and international criminal justice. And he has also then sort of pointed out the fact that there's such a gap in scholarship in looking at the role of Islamic law in relation to transitional justice. There's been a growth of scholarship looking at transitional justice, which includes international criminal justice. But most of this scholarship doesn't actually include or pay any heed to the role of Islamic law therein. So he actually, in this article, really called for and urged a renewed focus on the role that Islamic law norms and actors and institutions can play in resolving conflict. So that's both in relation to war, but also in terms of finding peace and reconciliation. So it was really from his call that I took up this interest in looking at this issue. There are plenty of opportunities for Islamic law to really play a key role in transitional justice in places like Syria and Yemen today. And there have been some studies on its limited application in places like Iraq and Tunisia. But most of these studies really say that it's only had limited application in practice and that there really is much more room to improve here. So this is something that I think is going to be growing in the scholarship, and I know is also a important part of the work that Ahmed has been doing at the ICRC as well, in trying to raise awareness of these tools that the international community has at their disposal, but are not yet engaging with.
Ahmed, are there any areas where Islamic law is more protective of victims' rights than what we would call modern international humanitarian law?
Thanks, Melinda. Before I answer your question, if I may follow on Julie's comment about the late Professor Bassioni. And in fact, after the book that you referred to, Julie, he had started already an edited volume in Sharia and post-conflict justice. And I have at that time finished and contributed a chapter on post-conflict justice in Islamic law, jihad and rebellion. This was the title suggested by him, but unfortunately the project never saw the light because his demise. So yes, indeed, there is a lot of room to be done in this in post-conflict justice settings as well. And for your question, Melinda, yes. Before I answer the question, in fact, Islamic law developed the detailed rules regulating the use of force during war. And in fact, it's quite remarkable that Muslim jurists going back to the 7th century, the early battles in the first battle in Islamic history in March 624, and after the subsequent generations of most Islamic jurists already discussed, negotiated, and developed ways to regulate the ways Muslims conduct hostilities, both during what we call today international and non-international armed conflicts. But they have unique, of course, definition of these categories because of the government system at this time that combines all the Muslims under one umbrella regime. And this was for the also similar purpose to IHL, which is to alleviate the suffering of victims of armed conflict. So for example, classical Muslim jurists developed a number of principles that aim, for example, to one, protect and civilians and non-combatants, two, to prohibit certain indiscriminate weapons, three, to prohibit certain indiscriminate methods of warfare, and 4, protect property, 5, prohibit mutilation, 6, to ensure humane treatment of prisoners of war, 7, there was a system called the AMAN or safe conduct and quota, whereby if enemy combatant during hostilities asks for quota, they cannot be harmed. And likewise, if a citizens of an enemy state wants to enter Islamic territories, then they have the right to be protected during their stay, which is more or less similar to the visa rights now. And finally, we find also that human dignity is one of the core principles when it comes to these rules. But for your question about if there are some Islamic rules that are more protective, in fact, I think the most important element here when it comes to Islamic law is it has what I call a built-in compliance system, which means that if Muslims know and acknowledge these Islamic rules, then they will abide by these rules. And as we all know, the main challenge to IHL, as well as other legal frameworks, is compliance, of course. But when I mentioned before that Muslims also need, have different rules regulating international armed conflict versus non-international armed conflict, what they meant at this time by the equivalent of what might be called a non-international armed conflict is inter-Muslim fighting. And in this case, we find far more restrictive rules than what we have in the current regimes or legal frameworks now. For example, in inter-Muslim fighting, there are 10 different rules of engagement, which includes that first, that the state governmental forces cannot initiate hostilities towards arms carriers. Of course, if they satisfy certain criteria, and when targeted, they cannot target to kill, because the main purpose behind the fighting between the governmental forces and armed rebels is just to stop them from their use of force and not to kill them per se. And this is why also one of the other different rules of engagement, that the use of force here must be limited to restricted to self-defense. And if they are escaping from the battlefield, they cannot be followed. And finally, one of the also more protective rules, that the two different parties to the conflict here, they have the equivalent combatant status, i.e. if the specific conditions are fulfilled, then after the cessation of hostilities, they have to be set free. Apart from this kind of inter-Muslim fighting, also in the case of the treatment of prisoners of war during captivity, we see that there is a huge attention to the humane treatment in terms of the right to food, to shelter, to clothing, to humane treatment, the prohibition of torture. And I could mention here even that a prominent jurist who is a founder of the Maliki School of Law was asked once if it is permissible for Muslims to torture prisoners of war to get from them military intelligence about the enemy. And his answer was quite remarkable. He simply answered that he has never heard that such thing could be permissible under Islamic law. So this shows that in 18th century common, in 8th century common era, the mere fact of even torturing an enemy prisoners of war to get military intelligence was even unheard of or unthinkable. I wanted to finish it by saying that I'm not here portraying a utopian picture about Islamic rules, because in fact you can find some jurists who adopt conflicting legal opinions, and this is a very rich and complex process among the pre-modern Muslim jurists between negotiating humanitarian rules that regulates the conduct of hostilities to alleviate the suffering of victims of armed conflict, and also between those who give priority to the pragmatic considerations of winning the war. But still, when we examine these rules, we can find that there is a huge room for this kind of humane protection that is much needed at the moment, especially if we take into account that at least about 2/3 of the armed conflicts are taking place in Muslim majority contexts.
Thanks very much, Ahmed. You've spoken a lot today about compliance and the extent to which a greater understanding or application of Islamic law can ensure compliance with obligations under international humanitarian law, even if not directly by analogy. Are you aware of examples where armed groups have applied Islamic law in order to comply with their obligations under international humanitarian law?
Yeah, I think there are different levels here. That there are some groups who, yes, applied Islamic law, but whether it is in order to comply with IHL obligations or to apply with Islamic law obligations. But I think we agree that both of them share common objectives, of course. So some of the examples I could mention here, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, MILF from the Philippines, they signed the deed of commitment banning anti-personnel mines and incorporated the relevant provisions in their code of conduct following recommendations from the Geneva Call. And Geneva Call is an organization that works mainly with non-state armed groups, and it's headquartered here in Geneva. And I think more information on this you can find also on their website. Also, in addition to this, the Taliban Code of Conduct, known as Laiha, which they published first in 2006 and updated in 2009 and 2010. And this Laiha or Code of Conduct, it focused on the internal organization of the Taliban, but also on rules regarding the conduct of war that the Taliban soldiers have to abide by. In addition to this, also other non-state armed groups develop codes of conduct, whether based solely on Islamic law or both Islamic law and IHL. And sometimes they mention that their sources are Islamic law, but we also respect IHL because they see no core contradictions between the two frameworks. Also, we can find sometimes the debates and deliberations among certain Islamic non-state armed groups over the legality or permissibility of the use of certain indiscriminate means and methods of warfare according to Islamic law. So this is even an ongoing debate about some of the or the use of certain means and methods of warfare are legitimate or not from Islamic law perspective. And finally, we also see another category of non-state armed groups who proclaim that they acknowledge no other legal source except Islamic law, and they are willing to engage or abide by Islamic law only, and if they engage in any discussion, it has to be based on Islamic law. So these are some of the examples that shows that some non-state armed groups use Islamic law or also IHL to comply with the humanitarian principles.
So, Julie, we've just been talking about humanitarian law, but you've also written a lot about human rights law and the extent to which Islamic law and religion in general can act as a bridge for domestic implementation of human rights and international criminal law. Can you explain what you mean by this concept?
Yeah, thanks, Melinda. So the idea really also goes back to what Ahmed said at the very beginning, where he talked about the fact that to many communities, international law is seen as European and therefore alien to non-European cultures. And this then causes sort of a gap in terms of connection with international law. My research has also found that even in many Western states, international law is seen as other and not something that should be readily adopted within the domestic context. There's been research, interestingly, done in the Netherlands, which also said that Dutch people didn't find much familiarity or reflection with international law, and it also seemed to be something that came from above or outside of the Netherlands. So I think sort of this perhaps suspicion of international law or lack of familiarity with international law impacts the way in which it is complied with or not. And I think in this way, religion and Islamic law specifically can help to be that bridge, as you say. If we can show that international law is actually very similar with local norms that do have familiarity and resonance with a local population, they are more likely to then comply voluntarily with those norms. And I've done research that looks at, you know, different types of local norms that we could use to connect. But Islamic law is certainly one that is very relevant, again, because of the number of Muslims around the world and the strength of Islamic norms often within those communities. So I look at international law and I look at mainly the branches of human rights law, humanitarian law, and criminal law, which all overlap in different ways. Fair trial rights are human rights, but they're also really important in international criminal law. And there are certain rights which also then can be seen as war crimes if they're violated in the context of an armed conflict. So there's a lot of overlap of international law branches at that level, where you can then look at and map out consistencies with Islamic law. And you don't have to take that from me. As I said, I'm not an Islamic scholar. There are plenty of other scholars who have mapped out, you know, this consistency between different bodies of international law and Islamic law. That includes scholars like Ahmed, who we have here, but also Mohammed Badarin, scholars like Abdul An-Naim. And they have really gone through and done this sort of mapping exercise to see where there is overlap, where there is perhaps some conflict or contestation. But in general, Badarin has concluded that Islamic law is not incompatible with the whole of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. An-Naim also concludes that Islamic traditions are generally consistent with human rights norms, albeit with some exceptions. And things here I could mention would be something like freedom of religion or belief, and then also some aspects of women's rights, he points out. But aside from some of these exceptions, there is overall harmony and consistency. And so that's where I then say we should use these overlapping bodies of law to try to build in voluntary compliance with international law within Muslim communities. And this is really important because, as Ahmed said, international law lacks really any sort of compliance or enforcement bodies. And therefore, they're so reliant upon having voluntary compliance. And if we can use these local normative systems that already have legitimacy and resonance within these populations, then we're halfway there.
Thanks very much, Julie. Now, Ahmed and Julie, we're going to round out today's discussion with a question for both of you. Whoever wants to jump in first, please do. And the purpose of this podcast is to promote understanding of the causes of torture and strategies for prevention and prohibition. Now, if you had one key recommendation based on our discussions today or any of your research, what would it be?
A key recommendation that I would have would build on my previous answer to say, look at local actors. So not just at the international level, but really look at the local actors at the grassroots level. And here I highlight women. Involving women and girls in these discussions is really, really crucial and something that I think is currently being neglected.
I think it's quite essential as well that we educate ourselves about other legal frameworks and local traditions, because I think we can learn from each other on one hand. And what I would say also here, something that we didn't have the chance to discuss during this podcast is that I think also other lawyers from different parts of the world need to discover their rich legal heritage and not to shy from writing in English or international languages, because I see that particularly in the legal systems in many Muslim majority countries, it is now overtaken by mainly civil law systems, and Islamic law and its rich potential contribution has been also overlooked, not only by the international community, but also by lawyers or Muslim lawyers, particularly those who are not specialists in Islamic law. So I think there could be also a room for comparative legal approach that to universalize these human values. And of course, torture and the prohibition of torture is something that that no culture or legal tradition can accept.
Ahmed, I really love what you just said about learning and listening from each other. And that's certainly what I've been doing for the last hour. I have learned and so much from the both of you, and I can't wait for our listeners to do the same. This has been a fascinating podcast, and I think your research, both yours, Ahmed, and yours, Julie, is truly groundbreaking, and I think will really inform the approaches of international organizations, various actors, and ensure through that greater compliance of these norms that we're all dedicated, that is human rights law, humanitarian law, and ensuring that there's a bridge that ensures their compliance. So thank you so much to the both of you.